Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte, episode 93 for October 29th, 2009. Puppet.
This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers free Libre and open source software with our host, Randall Schwartz of Stonehenge.com. He's Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. John O'Bacon has the week off. Hi, Randall.
Hey, Leo. Good to talk to you again. Very nice to be doing yet another show from you. And this time I'm actually home. I'm not in some crazy hotel in Burbank, California. Although, actually, for next week's show, I will be back in that very same hotel, maybe even the very same room, because the client wants me to come back. Apparently, he hasn't fired me yet, so I can keep working for them, which
is always nice. Yeah, when they ask you to come back, that's good. That's a good sign. Unless it's a dentist. When the dentist asks you to come back, that's not good.
I have the lovely, if you're watching on the live stream or watching on the video download, there's a you see the wonderful stained glass behind me that everybody was asking about for the last few weeks, saying, where's that stained glass? And, well, it wasn't home.
So we're going to get him a green screen, and he can have that stained glass everywhere he goes.
That would be cool. That would be very cool, actually.
Right, even behind you as you walk.
Yep. So, and actually, you know, since last week's show, I want to mention the faux pas that I made, which is just really crazy.
No,
you know, we had Bree Pettis.
No, you never make faux pas.
But the problem is we had Bree Pettis on the show last week talking about MakerBot. A lot of good feedback on the show, by the way. And again, I want to go spend $750 and get one of those now, but, you know, budget doesn't quite allow for it, but we'll see. Maybe sometime soon. But it was really funny. It was pointed out to me later after the show was over taping that Bree Pettis created Ignite. And so here I am talking about being on Ignite, and I didn't ask Bree any questions about it, which is just silly.
You're kidding.
No, Bree's one of the co-founders of the whole Ignite sequence.
That's so cool.
And I had no idea that there was
no overlap. Now, remind people about Ignite, because you're going to be speaking there soon. And in fact, you put a Dropio link on Twitter where people can look at your speech ahead of time.
Yeah, so what Ignite is, this started about 6 or 7 years ago. It was based on the original model of the lightning talks that were at OSCON and other places, where you get only 5 minutes to talk about something that interests you. Ignite makes it a little more formal than that, in that it's 5 minutes. You're allowed a slide deck, but the slide deck is automatically advanced every 15 seconds and has to be totally static.
No matter what you say or do.
Yeah, so the slide deck's running automatically behind you.
Wow.
And so part of the trouble is figuring out, how do you drive this without being driven by the slide deck? You know, and how do you coordinate with the slide deck that changes automatically to move you along? And there have been a number of these. I think they've been in something like 30 different cities. But there was a pitch for one or a call for papers for one in Portland. And I hadn't thought about doing it, but apparently they moved the deadline back a week. And I said, oh, what the heck? Let me go ahead and try this. And my talk has been accepted. And so I'm actually at the Ignite Portland on November 19th. It's free. The details are at igniteportland.com, so you can go there and find the details for that. It will be recorded and pushed to, you know, Google Video and YouTube and stuff, so my performance eventually will be up there for that. But my talk is on karaoke for fun and profit. And
where does the profit come in, just out of curiosity?
The title is almost unrelated to what the talk is about. You know how that works. That's the best way to make it work.
Yeah.
I just wanted to have a quick title that would catch people's eyes. But really, the pitch is that when I started being in front of people, I was really scared and had horrible stage fright. And karaoke got me over that.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
Without the idea of karaoke to do that, I probably wouldn't even be doing this show. I wouldn't have been on your TV shows. I wouldn't be podcasting. I probably wouldn't have been a world famous trainer over the years. You know, a lot of things wouldn't have happened had it not been for karaoke for me. So
how interesting. That's a very interesting story.
So it's a quick 5 minute presentation about that, about how to use karaoke to get over your stage fright by using me as an example. And I even mentioned how it created an entire industry, that the whole Insight Cruises actually came out of the fact that Neil had seen me do karaoke and said, oh, hey, these geeks, when they let loose, actually have a lot of fun. And that started the whole cruises. Yeah, so I helped Neil create Insight Cruises because of my presentation of karaoke that one night when he was watching me after class one day.
Well, I'll be diggity danged.
So it's all tied together. By the way, Leo, Neil says you got to come back on another cruise.
Oh, he wants me back after the incident, huh?
Even
I guess he has
incident.
A short memory.
Well, you know, he wants you on Mac 10.
I really didn't mean to throw up in his shoes. That it was a combination of Mai Tais and the boat rocking and your singing, to be honest. So
he really did enjoy you on the last cruise.
No, we had fun on the last cruise. It was great. I really enjoyed it. Now, the next one is Mac Mania 10 is to Bermuda.
Exactly. So we go in and out of the Bermuda Triangle. So hopefully that doesn't mean we get lost. But
anyway, I've been there before with the Neil. And yeah. He got a little, you know, faded, but he came right back. So I think we don't have to worry. Now, I saw your tweet saying all you wanted was me and Waz on the cruise.
That would be cool. Yes. Well, Waz may be there. I can't promise it at this point, but Waz may be on the
He's done at least two or three Geek Cruises. I know. I've been on two with him.
Yeah, and in fact, he met his current wife on one of the Geek Cruises.
That's right. Janet.
Yes, Janet.
Yeah,
exactly.
Is a Geek
exactly.
Cruiser.
Exactly. And also, speaking of that, I was at Neil's house on Saturday, and I was talking about the MakerBot episode from last week, and they had a guest over who was a researcher in the area of fruit flies. And as I'm talking about how this MakerBot can print up these 3D plastic things, she said, oh my God, this would be so cool, because she's constantly milling these believe it or not, these little torture chambers for fruit flies to see if they can get all the way out. And so they put them inside the center.
Drosophilus melanogaster torture chambers. Next.
Exactly.
Yes.
So she was talking about, well, you mean you could just give a 3D design to it and it prints it up and then we could use it for, I go, yeah. So she goes, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to get Caltech or wherever she's at. I forget where she's studying this stuff. But, you know, she's going to have to get one of these. So here's an example of something that where I was just happened to be on a show and it just happened to be something that, you know, dinner conversation, it happened to be something useful for her. So she's going to see if she can get the school to get one of those for her. So she can print this stuff up or find one that's nearby. So being in SoCal, it's probably going to be easy to find something down there that will coordinate very well. So that was great. I love the fact that we can do that with shows. Since last week's show, I've also been interviewed on another podcast. I've been interviewed on the Command Line podcast, which is at thecommandline.net. It was about a 45-minute conversation, talked about a lot of different things. I mentioned Floss Weekly in there a couple times. And actually, he interviewed me because of Floss Weekly. So he was really happy to see some of the other parts of my life. And it overlaps somewhat, but is distinct somewhat, because he's more of a software technical guy, with the interview that I had with the Linux Outlaws the week before. So if you listen to one, you can listen to the other and not be entirely bored. I think the only thing actually it had in common was karaoke. The rest of it was all distinct, so it was very nice being able to go through that with a couple of different other interviews. It's fun being on the receiving side of interviewing after having done so many interviews the other way, because I was able to like just stop talking when I was done with an answer, and it was up to them to start asking the next question. You know, being the questioner, we're constantly wondering, when are they going to stop talking so we can ask the next question, right? So it was great being on the other side of that, just abruptly stopping every once in a while to see if they were ready.
That's a good idea, actually. That's a great idea. Say, okay, I'm done. Fun. I'm done.
Yeah. Next. And speaking of done, can we talk about our guest for today?
The Puppet Master is here.
The Puppet Master. That's right. I don't know if you'll be able to see his strings on the video, but this is Luke Knies. I think that's the right way to pronounce it. I blew it a couple times last week, a couple weeks ago. But he is the creator, instigator, main investigator, main producer, and distributor of a tool for configuration management. Now, that sounds like really boring stuff, but I tell you, being a sysadmin for many years, configuration, getting the system exactly right, was one of the problems that we were constantly facing. We create all these ad hoc tools to do that, and knowledge we had that applied to a Linux box wouldn't necessarily apply to a Solaris box, so we're constantly relearning, okay, what's this command, what's that command? And I understand that Puppet really sort of abstracts that all away from all of us to make it just a little bit easier to be a sysadmin. So I'm really glad he's on here. And I also have some questions to ask, because I'm actually needing to use something like Puppet to put stuff in the cloud, like for insightcruises.com for Neil. So I'm definitely looking at that.
Well, let's get the Puppet Master on. So we have on the line from Nashville, Tennessee, Luke Knies of Reductive Labs. Hi, Luke.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Is Nashville a hotbed of open source programming?
you may want to start again because I'm actually in Portland now. I just moved from.
There's your answer.
This is why you should ask him where we're talking to you from.
Well, it says on your Skype, Nashville. That's all. I just going by what it says on your Skype.
Update your Skype
profile.
I recommend
not believing Skype. I lie outrageously on it. I think I have a false birthday on there, and all of my friends get some sort of fake birthday notification. Shoot. So,
hey, cancel the cake. So, have you now or have you ever lived in Nashville?
I was there until July of this year. Oh, yes.
Okay.
And all of the kind of initial development, I mean, the 4.5 years I spent working on Puppet previously was all in Nashville. So it's just recently we moved right around the time we took investment at the company. And the reason we left is exactly because Nashville is indeed not a hotbed of open source. It's a great place for medical industry. It's a great place for health insurance. It's a great place for country music. We're not really any of those. So we went someplace we liked better that was better for the things we do.
But if you were ever going to write like a nuclear medicine for country singers program.
Yes, that's probably, I'd say there's some sort of cross-discipline degree you could work on that would work perfectly across all of Nashville's.
So I'm sure we botched our description of a puppet up. Well, I'm sure Randall knows what he's talking about, but I must have botched up these. So why don't you describe puppet to us, Luke?
Actually, my wife is the best at describing it because all she knows is the distillation of what I've been doing, what I've been talking about for the last 5 years. So hers is actually more useful, but I'll do my best to imitate hers. Puppet is essentially an open source framework and tool that allows you to manage large numbers of computers. So you explain to Puppet what you want all of your web servers and mail servers and database servers and whatever servers or workstations or laptops to look like, and it makes sure they look like that. And it does that from the day you start until the day you turn the stupid computer off.
Wow.
So it's a configuration tool of some kind. Is it only useful if you have hundreds of computers, or is it useful for one machine?
It depends on what your definition of useful is. There's a cost to using any tool, and Puppet has some cost. It's probably one of the simplest tools out there that does this, so its cost is lowest. But if you know your computer very well and you only have one computer, it's likely that Puppet is not worth it to you. I do know Valerie Aurora is a kernel developer, and she uses Puppet because she rebuilds her computer constantly. In her situation, it's useful for that one computer. But if you don't change things very often and you don't rebuild it, you just do backups periodically, maybe not useful. There are plenty of people who use it on tens, maybe 50, 100 machines, and there are people who use it on thousands of machines. So it scales pretty well. My goal is to have it scale down to the one computer very effectively, but I think to do that, you have to have a lot more content. You have to have a lot more built-in solutions that we currently don't have. So
let me describe to you what brought me to Puppet initially, because this is actually what started this conversation. Although now that I review my notes, we've actually been chatting longer than having this conversation started. Let me just use English at some point here. Anyway, so I'm moving insightcruises.com from a shared machine that I had for stonehenge.com up into the cloud, so Amazon EC2. And as I was starting to try to configure all this new stuff, I had to use tools for OpenSolaris that were different from the tools that I was used to using in OpenBSD and different from the tools still that I use in OS X. And somebody suggested to me in the chat room for OpenSolaris, they said, why don't you start using Puppet to manage your configuration? Because this will also be nice if you decide to scale multiple machines, because you can capture the common things easily and the differences easily in some nice, easy script. Is that a typical problem space that Puppet is addressing?
Exactly. A lot of the kind of abstractions in Puppet are a result of my using CFEngine trying to solve heterogeneous solutions with existing tools and didn't do it very well. So in Puppet, one of my main goals is to make it so that you didn't have to spend all of your time dealing with inane details that are different between different platforms or different between one organization and another. Do I really care what your domain is? I don't really. So you kind of put it in one place and then not think about it again. I don't want to know whether it's RPM-I or RPM-, is it like Gem does this? If you're using Gems, it's uninstall or remove. If you're using RPMs, it's kind of all the commands are different. No, I don't want to know. You probably don't want to know. So Puppet takes that, encodes it in one place for you. You just say, I would like a package installed. Its name is this, and Puppet figures the rest out.
Wow. So I don't have to learn the native tools then and not so much care about that. I have to be able to say this eventually comes from an RPM distribution somewhere, but I don't really have to learn the specific tools of RPM then.
You may not even need to say it comes from an RPM distribution. The things you have to get right are you have to get the name of the package right. So you can't say I want to install a package SSH when it's actually called OpenSSH. But as long as the computer knows how to talk to your package distribution and the couple linkage points are correct, which is mostly the name, then it'll just work. You don't even have to do anything.
So I could say, for example, that I want to be sure that the latest version of OpenSSH is installed on my laptop, which is running OS X, and the recipe for it would look very similar to saying, I want OpenSSH, the latest version, installed on my Amazon EC2 Open Solaris box.
I would love to say yes to that, but the truth is there's no real way to separately upgrade SSH on your laptop unless you're using like Mac ports or something like that. If you're using Mac ports, then yes, it would look very similar.
Wow, that's a real convenience because I know I go crazy trying to figure out all these different configuration commands. So there's one layer of abstraction in here away from the installation commands and the management commands to something that's a little more abstract, that's more cross-platform. But what I also saw as I was going through the Puppet documentation was the way to capture similarities in a cluster of machines. Can you describe what that's about?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean, but... Well, maybe you can elaborate on what you saw there, and then I can try to...
So what the hell are you talking about, Randall?
Well, it looked like, for example, let's say I had 5 web servers whose was pretty much the same configuration, you know, the same place where the log files go and stuff in each machine, but they had a different domain name or maybe a different IP address that they wanted to bind to, or maybe 2 of them used one MySQL cluster and the other 3 used a different MySQL cluster. But it looked like there was a way to capture the common things,
right. But
still differentiate that through the use of like macros or functions or something.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that really surprised me about the existing configuration management systems that were around when I started Puppet. Essentially, none of them had a real... something that looked like a macro or a function, something you could say, I've got a bunch of stuff I want to do, and it should have some parameters, and I want to do that a bunch of times. It's a pretty easy concept. So in Puppet, what we do is, everything we talk about is resources, these things we want to manage, the users, groups, packages, services, you know, all the things we care about. So what we allow you to do is to build basically an aggregate, a composite resource that, so if you're talking about you're building a web service, then maybe it consists of the virtual host definition for Apache plus all of the content plus some setting somewhere that says here's the name, here's the IP address. So they kind of the resources themselves and the configurations that go into making sure those resources are correct. You can encapsulate all that into one big website or web service instance resource, have as many instances of those as you need. You know, you've got one in this cluster or you've got 10 instances in this cluster that are slightly different based on host name or based on where they are in the rack or, you know, whatever kind of arbitrary weirdnesses you're going to do. And you just change the bits you absolutely have to change for it to work correctly. And the rest of it's just in a common location, you know, the best code is.
So even things like I need to have the same username across all these machines so that I can SSH back and forth, the way to create that user might be different if I have OpenBSD on one and Linux on another.
Yeah, that stuff's trivial.
Wow. I could have used this a couple of years ago. I was working for a very large company that whose name ends in an exclamation mark. And one of the things we were doing is, maybe Puppet's already been applied to something like this, but one of the things that would happen is the developers would build systems that were complex, that required combinations of hosts to work together, and they all needed to know about each other. But then as you would move that from development to staging to integration to testing, actually the way around, but and then finally to deployment, those names of those hosts would change. Is that something that Puppet's been used for?
People don't usually, I know people do change names of Puppet. There are many installations where the name doesn't have much meaning. And so it's kind of, it can be dependent on DHCP or it can be changed based on the service that the host is providing. Puppet by default has a pretty strong link between the configuration of the host and the name of the host. How it generally figures out what configuration that host is supposed to have. But it also provides plenty of flexibility for you to say, well, I want to have some kind of arbitrary UUID or something like that to do the linkage instead. So I have seen people do that, and certainly Puppet has built-in support for multiple environments. So if you've got development, staging, and production, then Puppet supports that directly for you.
And how about ongoing updates? Is this just for an initial build, or Can I tell Puppet to like wake up every hour and do something?
Yeah, so they're entirely idempotent, and the default configuration, they run every half an hour. So if you make any change to your central definition of what a web server looks like, then that definition by default will deploy within a half an hour on your entire infrastructure. And you can force it to go faster if you want, but that's the kind of default flow. And if there's nothing to be done, you know, on average, you haven't changed very much, if anything, of your configuration. So Puppet checks the configuration, says, everything's good and doesn't do anything. But for the things that have changed, either because you've changed the central store or because the local configuration state has drifted, somebody's gone in and made a change they shouldn't have made, then Puppet will automatically, you know, bring the machine up to date.
So maybe one example of this would be if I'm running a classroom and I have maybe 10 machines that are more particularly for teaching web dev and maybe 10 machines that are more about just teaching general system administration. I might have tasks common to all of them that need to be updated from time to time from a central location, and Puppet would be able to handle that. And then the specific machines might have separate clusters of things.
Yes, definitely.
Now, how does a Puppet on one machine communicate then with this, I guess it's a central server that talks about what the master configurations are?
There are multiple ways I could interpret your question, but mostly I assume you mean how does it get information to other machines? I mean, the network communication is quickly converting from XML RPC to a kind of RESTful style JSON YAML communication. In general, the nodes can't communicate directly with each other for most of what amounts to security reasons. You don't want to have tainted content from one client ended up in another client's configuration file because that's dangerous. So the server has pretty complete control over what content makes it onto various clients. But in the course of, so one of the things that's pretty different about Puppet relative to other tools is you don't have to configure it this way, but by default, all of the compiling, all of the process of turning all of your code into a static data configuration, all of that happens on the server. And this means that the server can do a lot of database access and general munging in a very safe way. You're not having your clients hit password databases. You're not having your clients say, hey, every Nagios server should have this configuration file, or every database server should have this configuration file. So on the server, you can have one client export configuration information to another client. And by that means, you can say every web server should automatically configure its existence in, say, the load balancing pool, or every server should automatically set up the monitoring configuration for that server. And it's completely safe because you don't have tainted information from the client going onto the server. This is all server side. But it's the server doing compiles in the context of a given client in a way that can affect the configuration of other clients.
Can I run the client side in, say, a manual pull mode? Like, I'm not always connected to the network, but I want to be updated when I am?
Yes.
And can I also run it in, like, a dry run mode to kind of see what it would change on my system before it actually changes it? Very cool.
And quite a few people actually run constantly in a dry run mode because they have very stringent change control rules, and then that sends a report back to the server, which goes into some sort of database of the web UI, and then some human has to go through and say, yes, I approve this actual change, and then a human will go to that computer and run Puppet manually and say, okay, yes, I want to actually fix the changes that need to be done.
Oh, so, that's an amazing, that's a great workflow then for that sort of thing. Cool. Now,
not so fun. It works well for some people.
Well, I mean, if you're in that kind of an environment, it sounds like at least there's a tool then to solve most of the problem for you. And then you've got the wonderful administration things to worry about after that. So
exactly.
Now, how do the files, so you're just using straight TCP connections? Do you share with NFS those, the data files, or is it all through this one tube between the Puppet client and the Puppet servers?
Well, all the communication that Puppet daemons do to each other is HTTPS, but there's no rule that says you have to use those daemons. So if you want to do file serving and all of your files are already on NFS, it would be silly to require that you send the files through a pipe and not just use NFS instead. So all you do there is, if you're doing file serving specifically, then you just refer to the apparently local files, which are of course actually, you know, over NFS, but Puppet doesn't know that. Just, you know, Puppet's just either, it's a remote file or it's a local file. So, and plenty of people do NFS based files, and it can be a good benefit.
Cool. So what does Puppet run on? Is it pretty portable?
If you can get Ruby running on there, you can almost definitely get Puppet running on something that at least resembles complete functionality. In terms of the operating systems that I consider to be 100% supported, it's obviously, you know, Red Hat, Debian, Solaris, But beyond the really common ones, you've also got FreeBSD, OpenBSD, NetBSD, Gentoo, SUSE. I think it's not Rock Linux. There are some really Arch Linux, I think, runs Puppet. AIX and HPUX, I've got customers, paying customers who are using it on both of those. I actually can't think of a Unix that anybody still uses. Maybe Slackware. My understanding is somebody out there does still use Slackware. I don't know of anybody running Puppet on Slackware. But that's probably the only one I can think of that I've really, you know, maybe Mandriva. I don't, you know. It's pretty much runs everywhere, basically.
Android?
I know of someone who has got it running on his iPhone. I don't know of anybody
iPhone,
specifically.
All right.
Got it running
wow. What would you do with it? You'd have to be obviously a jailbroken iPhone. Yeah.
I think you're pretty much just doing something to prove a point at that point. Yeah. You're not really hoping to manage your iPhone. You're hoping to get on Bling Bling.
That's quite cool. And so you say it's written in Ruby. Do I need to know Ruby to use it though?
No, you don't need to. If you want to get crazy and do interesting, complicated, sophisticated, and annoying things, then yes. But the vast majority of users know no Ruby and need to know no Ruby.
But they should. They should anyway.
You're 10% more attractive if you know how to write
Ruby. Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know,
that explains my demise.
Yeah.
So, but you say so. That's for the cases where there isn't already a low level rule to do what you need to do, right? So you're basically building new low-level rules.
And even then, you can actually build the equivalent of those low-level rules in Puppet. It's just not quite as flexible. It doesn't have, you know, maybe the data validation you're looking for. And of course, you're going to pay some speed costs and not doing it directly in the ultra-fast low-level Ruby. Yes,
because you can call out to the shell for a rule, for example, right?
Right. So you can build these same composite resource types. You can build from exec resources that can be done idempotently. So say if you've got, you know, we're working with a customer converting their defined resource types that to manage Linux LVM resources like volume groups, logical volumes, things like that. So they've got a bunch of Puppet code that manages that, but it's all execs. And that's basically shell scripts that say, if this logical volume already exists, then don't do anything. And if it doesn't exist, then create it with these parameters. We're converting that to pure Ruby because they want to have a little more functionality. They want to have a little more confidence in the inputs going into those so that they don't accidentally try to create, you know, a volume group that doesn't make any sense. So
you said you started this as a part of your reaction to things that CF Engine wouldn't do. Can you contrast what Puppet does that CF Engine doesn't?
Well, CF Engine does not have, so I will say I don't know as much about CF Engine 3, which just came out somewhat recently.
Okay.
So I can't entirely speak to that, but CF Engine does not have this idea of these abstract resources. So you can talk about shell commands, but you can't talk about services. And really, I don't want to talk about shell commands. I don't want to talk about the difference between starting services on, say, Solaris versus starting them on OS X versus starting them on Red Hat. To me, it's all SSH. It also didn't have this ability to give a conceptual thing, a thing that I think is one thing. There's only one SSH service. It might be called OpenSSH or SSHD or OpenSSHD, and it might involve launchd or SMF, but I don't really care. To me, is SSH running? Can I connect to port 22 with this protocol? That's what I want to know. And it didn't have that ability to give it that common name in one place. So if you were managing SSH on three platforms using CF Engine, which I've done, then what you amounted to having to do is have three completely unrelated SSH solutions on each platform, and you really couldn't turn it into one common problem. So that was one big problem I had. And then the dependency situation in CF Engine was the only word I can come up with is heinous. So in Puppet, you can directly say, this resource requires this other resource, or this resource should be restarted if this resource changes. And so I subscribe to any changes on this resource. In CF Engine, you had to do really complicated things like, if this resource changes, it sets this Boolean flag somewhere. And then somebody else says, hey, if this Boolean flag is set, you know, do something. But if you were doing services, in one place you'd say you start the service one way, you start the service like this, and somewhere else you'd say, if this flag is set, then restart the service. And those were completely different chunks of code. They weren't related at all. So you have three different parts of your configuration that have to be perfectly tuned to make your service running and restarted correctly, and give that to a novice and say, understand that, and they couldn't.
And don't break it if you maintain it.
Exactly. And it didn't help that I actually rewrote the parser for CF Engine a couple of years ago when I was trying to decide whether I should fork CF Engine or start again from scratch. And CF Engine had what they thought was a single consistent configuration language, but in terms of a YAC style grammar, there were 25 separate syntaxes in the quote unquote single language.
Ooh.
So that made it tough to use too.
I did notice that some pieces of your syntax, you say this is like Ruby. That's where I sort of wondered how much Ruby I needed to know.
It's actually, like all languages, right? There hasn't been a completely from scratch, clean slate definition of a new language in a long time. You can't help but learn from the other languages you've written. You can't write a language without knowing how to program, and the languages you already know affect your programming. So mm-hmm. Puppet's syntax is pretty heavily influenced. I would say mostly it looks like Nagios configuration files, because Nagios is a pretty simplistic data format that, it's a relatively compressed, low punctuation way of expressing exactly what you need to do. In terms of how you throw some extra syntax around the extra functionality Puppet needed, some of that looks a little bit like Ruby. Some of it looks a little bit like, I have no idea. Some of it looks a little bit like maybe crap would be the right word. I'm not sure.
can I get started with this incrementally? Like, can I play with this on my local box and have it like just flip like the web on and off or something simple?
No, if you only talk about everything. If you talk about one resource on your host, then Puppet will just remove everything else on your entire computer. Yeah, you can. You can definitely.
Are you serious?
No.
It's the first command is rm star.
Right. So that's rm rf star. Slate right there, and then there we you have to build it up.
Piece by piece.
Yeah. So you manage the things you want to manage, and if you tell Puppet, look, if there are parts of this that I'm not managing, then remove those. You can do that. You can tell Puppet to remove the bits you're not managing. But by default, it's entirely additive management. You manage the bits you want, and then it ignores the rest.
Mm, okay. Because I installed Puppet from MacPorts on my OS X box, and I was going to start playing with it. But then I wondered if it would start deactivating all the rest of my daemons and stuff without me asking it. So glad you answered.
No, no. It's not quite that hateful. And in fact, you can... you can scale very well from, I've got a very small, I want to write a small, simple example. So there are three main executables you're going to interact with in the Puppet world. There's the Puppet agent executable, the Puppet server executable, but then there's a standalone just Puppet executable. And this actually functions like a normal interpreter. So you can feed this on standard in Puppet code and it'll run that code. Or you can write a small script, stick it in your bin directory, make it executable and feed that to Puppet with your shebang. And Puppet will execute that like it would, like you'd expect any other interpreter to do. And mm-hmm. you can start that small. Or if you've got a moderately sized configuration and you don't want to go to the bother of having client server or, I've got customers who do this right now. They don't use client server mode for either architectural security or performance reasons. They'll send all the configs to the client. You can still use that individual executable to run all of your code. You can start very small, and then as you decide, okay, it makes sense to go centralized, it makes sense to start using the server, I want to have the reporting capabilities, then you start adding this kind of more sophisticated architecture.
What kind of, are there reporting and auditing things on the central server then, like when it downloaded stuff and what changes it made?
So I would say that our central server right now is we do have reporting, but in general, what we are best at today is providing the data, and then you're responsible for figuring out what the heck it means. We do send reports back to the server saying exactly what happened and all the things that happened and whether they succeeded or not. But there are multiple community solutions right now for taking that data and doing useful things with it. We don't currently provide one, but of course we're working on it. I mean, this is one of the reasons we did take investment in June, is so we can start building some of these kind of more interesting and more powerful tools to manage all the data that a Puppet installation generates.
Now that you mentioned, at work a couple times, how does this relate to your day job?
This is my day job and has been for 4.5 years.
That's impressive. I like that. What's the secret to making this pay?
Well, one of the things that there are a couple of things that are very different about Puppet compared to most open source projects. One is that it was founded with the explicit requirement that it be able to make money. One of the big frustrations I had with CF Engine is that its primary author is an academic. His mandate is to publish papers. If it so happens that it's really good for getting papers published and not at all good for solving your problems, that doesn't bother him really, because his mandate is solved. So I knew that if I produced a great tool that solved all the theoretical problems and was really, really awesome, but you weren't willing to use and you weren't willing to pay people to work with you on, then it wouldn't really solve the problem, because you wouldn't have enough people using it. You wouldn't have enough of a really a dynamic industry. So it was my plan from day one to make money. And one of the other things is I had been a CF engine consultant for 2 or 3 years. So I knew that I could go into a company and I could express what Puppet could do for them in terms of value in a way that they could not only understand, but be willing to pay for. So I could show up and I could talk to your manager, I could talk to your systems team, I could talk to your CIO and really say, look, here's what we're doing. Here's why we're doing this. Here's what kind of value it'll provide. Here's what you expect for your ROI. Here's how it will change the quality of service you see in your internal infrastructure. And I knew I could convince people to give me, at the very least, consulting dollars for that. And I was pretty sure I could get some minimal support contracts. So I started this in April of 05. And by January of 06, I had closed my first customer. And since 06, I've been subsisting entirely on the revenue I made with Puppet.
That's impressive. That's very
really,
cool.
That's a happy story. I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so how does the commercial side of your business then relate to the fact that Puppet is open source and people are contributing? How are those working and cooperating together?
I would say that it's actually even a stretch right now to say the commercial side of the business. There are people at Reductive Labs who write Puppet code, and there are people at Reductive Labs who don't write code. But in general, I mean, at this point, we essentially have no non-open source code. All the code we write makes it into the core or is customer specific and thus doesn't belong in the core. But in general, everything we do is entirely open source. We have the same open source business model problems that everybody else has. And I think the 451 group recently had a post about open source business model stages. And we're essentially at stage one or two of that process. We're probably sometime next year going to be producing some commercial modules. But we know that if you look at the world today, the percent adoption of tools like Puppet is extremely small. The biggest competition we still have today is with people who have written their own programs that some dude in a basement is maintaining, or you know, some dude in a basement wrote 8 years ago and no one is maintaining now, and it's kind of good enough, but everyone hates it just a little bit and everyone's a little bit afraid of it. And that's what we're competing against is 50,000 lines of Perl and Shell all wrapped up in a ball. And if we make decisions today that makes it less likely that those people will adopt Puppet in order for us to get 10% more revenue, or even frankly 100% more revenue, then all we're really doing is hurting our long-term prospects. So we're going to continue focusing as a company and as a project on adoption, on penetration, on getting more people using the product and more people, especially more people building other applications on top of Puppet. I mean, that's the real success. When you can point to another startup that their business model is based on Puppet, when you can point to another product that people love that requires Puppet to work successfully. That's my real definition of success. And we're seeing some of that. And the very second we start locking down things and saying, oh, well, there's a community version, but you shouldn't use it because it'll make your servers catch on fire. And there's an enterprise version that costs $1 billion. That's not going to do anybody. That's not going to help us succeed. It's just going to help us in our short-term revenue. And that's not going to be good.
That's an admirable goal there. I really appreciate you looking at the long run on this one. That's very, very good. One of the things I know, having been a lot of sysadmin for most of the last 25 years, is that the configuration is really just a mess. What I'm seeing as I'm staring at the Puppet stuff is a real clean solution to solving a lot of those problems. Has the feedback you've gotten from the community supported that? Are people raving about Puppet as soon as they discover it, that sort of thing?
I think my favorite thing about the Puppet project, the work I've done on it so far, is when people express actual emotional fondness for the product. I mean, it's like a ton of code that helps you be a sysadmin better. I mean, can you think of something like kind of more cold and boring, but people gush about Puppet, about how much time it saves them, how much it makes them happier about their jobs, how much happier it makes their bosses. I think people really do express, I can solve complicated problems very quickly and very simply in a way that makes me happy. So I love that.
And sysadmin is such a thankless job. I used to liken it to running from dogs. At best, you didn't get nipped very often. And at worst, the dogs were all over you. And that was about it.
Yeah, I mean, the sysadmin is one of those roles where, according to management, sysadmin should only ever be called if something's broken. The best sysadmin in the world doesn't exist because no one knows that person is there, because you never have an outage. You ask for something, it gets done immediately. So from the purposes of the rest of the organization, the only thing a sysadmin can do is delay the answering of a request, cause an outage, fix a problem. Like, those are all the things sysadmins can do. And this is what I think drives a lot of what I call Jenga system administration. People only touch computers when they're down. They kind of, there's an outage, and so everyone kind of builds this big stack of servers, and then it starts working, and everyone just backs away and says, "No one touch it," and no one goes anywhere near it until it falls over again, and then the CIO calls and says, "Ah, what did you do?" And you know, they kind of have to build their Jenga tower again. But that's the worst kind of administration, but it's the kind that's encouraged by organization because they don't want to hear from you ever. So yeah, it's very thankless. It's very, very hard to make other people happy. It's very hard to stay happy as a sysadmin, which is why I'm glad I don't do it anymore.
I've got to say, I do really relate, though, because one of the reasons that I spent a lot of time in my early days writing about Perl was to improve everybody's random shell and awk and sed scripts in at least one unified language to solve all that. And it sounds like what Perl did to the shell script, Puppet is doing to the configuration file. Would that be a fair comparison?
Yes, it exactly is.
That's very, very admirable. How big is your user community? Do you have a lot of people committing patches to the core repo?
Well, so there's the user community and developer community, and any open source project, you're going to have a wide gulf, in orders of magnitude gulf in those two. We figure we have on the order of thousands of installs, probably not tens of thousands of installs. It might be five figures, but if so, it's very low five figures. We've got probably, we've got about 1,500 people on our mailing list. We've got about 250 people on IRC at all times. And I think we actually have the largest systems-focused IRC channel out there, which I'm pretty proud of. Our IRC channel is very active. And, it's not always on topic Puppet. There's plenty of, general system stuff goes on there too. Because we're part of essentially every OS out there, it's hard to track things like downloads. But we think our community, like I said, in the order of thousands of people, but not probably tens or hundreds of thousands of people. But at the same time, I still, every week, every time I travel, I meet another company that's using Puppet that I didn't know about. So there are clearly lots of people who are using it that, just don't participate. So one of the things we're doing is we're building other forums. So the IRC and mailing lists works great for the early adopters, but I think it's less effective for the kind of more standard users. So as that community, that portion of the community grows, we're trying to address that and make them kind of more welcome and easier to get involved with. Things like forums and, whatever else these people use, I'm not quite sure yet.
Do people that are outside the company, your company, have commit access?
So we follow the Git and Linux style development. So we don't really talk about commit access per se because, for instance, I don't ever commit directly to the repository. We've got somebody who isn't actually at the company, James Turnbull, who wrote the Puppet book. He's essentially a release maintainer. He does all of the merging into the repository. So we have a ticket system where each ticket goes through a series of stages, and the last stage is, it's been tested, it's ready for check-in. At that point, or soon thereafter, James collects that ticket, finds the code in your Git repository online, and merges it in from there. So no, but it's not because we have a closed development community, it's because no one has commit access.
Okay, that makes sense. That's cool. What do you require methodologies like test-driven development? I mean, do you have to make sure there's a test for everything checked in?
Yeah, and it varies a little bit based on what you're adding, but we've had problems where people will add, say, a new resource type that works great for them, and we'll merge it into the repo, and then in 6 months, someone will start having bugs with it, and then we'll go, we'll find the person who wrote it and ask them how it's supposed to behave, and that person's not around anymore. They solved their problem. They scratched their itch. We merged their code. Well, their itch is scratched. They don't really want to help anymore. So our problem is the problem somebody else is having a bug, or is it a feature? Or if it's a bug, what's the best way to fix that bug? What should the actual behavior of, say, the interface type on Red Hat be? Do you know? Do you want to know? Who's willing to take the time to research what the desired, what the appropriate, what the best behavior is in a given place? Unless you provide tests with your code, we don't know how to fix bugs in your code because we don't know what the real desired, whether a given behavior is desired or accidental. We've essentially had to institute, you of course can't institute TDD. All you can institute is a requirement that there be tests and that they be a certain level of quality. You can't require they wrote them first. Although of course you can usually tell when they have or haven't. And I will say that a lot of Puppet was written with tests, but not written TDD. So we're slowly fixing that over time. But, we have to be strict on tests just because otherwise we can't support it.
Sounds fair. So what You mentioned, we mentioned, talked about CF Engine. What other things are in this space, and how would you contrast Puppet with those?
Well, I think, let's say there are probably 10 or 15 academic projects that have, you know, between 1 and 10 or 20 installations out there. So there are tools like Beaconfig 2 out of Argonne National Labs. I think there are a few installations out there. There's Quator, which was built to run the Large Hadron Collider. They've got a few installations. LCFG, which is, I think, the oldest, most mature, and least usable of the tools. Very inspirational, but even its author wouldn't recommend you use it. And then there are the commercial tools like Blade Logic and Opsware. These are very large companies that, you know, both of them have actually been purchased by other companies now. So if Opsware wasn't big enough, then how about HP? And Puppet doesn't really we find as a company that we compete with those tools, but in terms of what you'd expect Puppet to do for you versus what you expect Opsware to do for you, we don't make nearly as large a claim as they make, which means that we tend to actually solve problems more effectively because we're not saying we're going to fix the world. We do find ourselves compared to those tools too. So, and then the only other thing is there's a new tool called Chef that somebody essentially attempted to do a community fork. It's not a code fork, but they essentially did their best to take portion of our community and build a new product and a new tool. It's kind of a strange case where they built an open source project involving making all the contributors and community members sign NDAs for the first 6 months of the community. So that's a pretty strange setup. But
strange, yeah.
Yeah, so they got
that's actually a fork of Puppeten?
It's just a community. It's not a code fork. It's just almost the vast majority of people in their community are originally Puppet users and, you know, became disillusioned for some reason or another. And so they got the company behind it got investment, and then in the course of, you know, all under NDA, and at some point, you know, after the they decided it was acceptable to release, they started talking about it earlier this year.
So what's looking forward? What's next for Puppet? What are you still missing?
You know, I think the big things we're missing right now, we're definitely working on a kind of graphical dashboard, something that today, really, the only person who's going to know anything about Puppet is the sysadmin. And we think that's a flaw in that the manager should have a lot of status information. What's going on with my infrastructure? Are there outages? What are causing those outages? There are a lot of compliance and security-related concerns that go into a Puppet installation, but the compliance and security groups at these large companies can't directly relate the work they're doing to the actions that are happening on the network. So building some tools to allow those people to do that kind of correlation. We've got some of that in the works. That's obviously all a little bit more enterprise focused. But then there's also, I think we know a lot more about the things that are interesting about what we're doing. And so we're kind of trying to reframe some of the problems that we're solving. So Puppet is a very code focused solution right now. And I think that one of the big things we're trying to do is try to figure out how we can make it more of a data focused solution. So rather than talking about compiling and, generating reports, we can talk about, well, what's the current state? What's the desired state? How do you get a diff of those two? How do you, I'm not even sure how we're going to do this yet, but one of the insights I think I've gained recently is that having a much more data focused space is much more useful and interesting in the long run. It builds much easier integration. It's kind of the restful integration rather than the kind of XMRPC integration. It's hard to integrate with verbs. It's much easier to integrate with nouns.
Okay. And really are sure. You looking for specific kinds of people to help you with that?
Essentially, yes. I mean, the people who are willing to write code to help solve their own problems, and the people especially who have a certain idea of how they want the world to work. If you are extremely opinionated and are willing to write code, because opinionated people are easy to find, but mostly they just bitch. If you're extremely opinionated and are willing to hack your way to a coherent solution that works for you and your organization, we have a number of those in our community, and they consistently provide the best kind of context. And they don't always provide even necessarily contributions in the traditional patches sense, right? We don't getting patches from them necessarily. But if I'm thinking about adding a feature to Puppet, I can go to them and say, are you using something that looks like this? And if so, how are you using it? What kind of benefits do you have? Are there things you're doing that I haven't added to my model, that I haven't added to my concept, that I should be adding? Are there problems that you're solving that I'm not going to solve? Or even worse, are there problems that you're solving that my solution is going to make it impossible to solve effectively? So, if you've got a complete solution, if you've got hard problems and a willingness to solve them, doing that with Puppet means that you're able to help the rest of the community out as long as you can talk about it some.
Cool. And specific skill sets you're looking for people too with Ruby skills and sysadmin
Ruby and developers, experience? We have a surprisingly small number of Ruby developers involved in the project because sysadmins aren't developers. And Ruby developers, so Puppet has its own non-Ruby language, and the Ruby developers think that everything should just be in Ruby. And we're experimenting with that some, but you still have to mostly stick to the Puppet language to do the actual configurations. But we just hired two pretty big Ruby community members, and we're hoping that will change that to some extent. It's affected our reputation some in the Ruby community. We're hoping to see more Rubyists adopt and contribute to Puppet. But yeah, I mean, Ruby skills, modeling skills. If you're a big fan of CSE things that you didn't think you'd ever have a chance to deal with, like directed acyclic graphs and parser generators and things like that, we've got those in Puppet, and not a lot of people do these days. So.
And also maybe a translation. You're looking for people to translate your documentation to other languages?
We haven't had that requested yet, but I think that would be great. We don't have support for that built in yet. So we don't have all the documentation extracted in a way that's easy to do. And so there's kind of, if you want to do that, it would require both some coding to make that feasible and then the actual translation itself. So
maybe if somebody's itch to scratch is internationalization of Puppet, there's plenty of opportunity, you're saying, for that.
Definitely.
Very cool. Is there anything else you want to talk about? I think we've covered Puppet pretty well, but what did I leave out?
You guys are the Puppet masters.
It's not my fault that my nick on Twitter is Puppet Master D. It's I get introduced as the Puppet Master all the time. So yeah, whether we want to or not, we are the Puppet Masters. I think that's one of the best things about the name is the opportunity for kind of jokes and puns and funny names has been a great benefit to the naming of the product.
Well, it's a good name. I mean, it kind of says what it does and all that too. I mean, it's a good name. I like it.
Yeah. So I think the only thing that I would also, I think is important about Puppet is that in talking about Puppet and presenting about Puppet, I've generally focused on its utility as a tool rather than its utility as a platform. But in reality, there are actually a lot of ways to integrate with Puppet. There are a lot of interesting things you can do. So Stanford, for instance, has a CMDB project that they're feeding from Puppet, where they've got a lot of data that Puppet's generating that's going directly into their CMDB. And it wasn't a complicated integration at all. It was a pretty straightforward integration. We've got a lot of people who have, if you've already got a collection of all the data, all the hosts you have and what classes they're in, it's pretty trivial to hook that database into Puppet. So another one of our big financial customers is doing this, where they don't have to duplicate this information. So Puppet as a platform, Puppet as a means of solving other problems that are kind of related but not directly systems problems, Puppet is great for that too. And it doesn't show up in the documentation as much, and it doesn't show up in the presentations because people kind of find it boring. But if you think to yourself, oh, it looks very kind of closed system, it looks very, the edges curve in rather than out. That's only because of what the community is interested in hearing, and in actuality, a lot of our paying customers tend to integrate it with a lot of their systems. So it's a very good platform too.
Amazing! This has definitely opened my eyes. I really appreciate you being on the show today and talking to us about this. And I'm sure you'll get a few new people that are interested in Puppet as well, because we do have a couple of listeners out there.
Great, and I thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it, Luke. Take care. Great.
You too.
He's probably just down the street from you, Randall. I didn't know he was in Portland. Did you?
He
know
probably he, is. He probably
could have just wandered that over.
that's the van out there, right there. I see that van.
That's him.
We're the vans from last week's show. Now there's vans from this week's show. Man, I've got to stop talking about topics like that.
That's very funny. Black vans. Scary black vans.
Well, this looks again like one of these things. I mean, I don't know how I keep doing this, but I keep bringing these people on the show that are about things that I need to go use right away now.
Well, that's a sign that you're doing the right thing, you know, that you're...
Must be. Yeah. And we're getting a lot of reports of that from our listeners, too, which is also very cool. I love getting... I'm probably getting about 30 pieces of mail for Floss Weekly every day. And so if I don't get immediately back to you guys, hey, it's not personal. I'm just trying to plow my way through all this stuff, especially suggestions for new guests and phone or email addresses for guests that I don't have the addresses for, and I really appreciate all that.
We should remind people, though, that the best way to mention a guest is not to send me or Randall an email, because I'm starting to get a lot of email from people, and that's not what you want, is it?
Well, if you send me email, it's fine. But if you just mention a project, it doesn't really help me. I have to go do all the research, and there's a lot of low-hanging fruit already on the list linked from twit.tv/floss. If you go look there, you'll see there's a spreadsheet link there that has 190 names now? 223 names. Oh, so if it's one of those, I probably know about it already. And if it's not on there, please... the best way to get them right up to the top of that list is to write the project leader and explain what Floss Weekly is and have them email me. And then they'll go right to the top of the list. That's always the easy way to get that to happen. So if you have a favorite project, do the legwork for me and you will definitely get to the front of the queue. Otherwise, you're going to go somewhere in the middle of the queue. Might not get to it till like next year. So definitely. And in fact, speaking about that, let me talk. I've actually got a couple new bookings since the last time we talked. We have, of course, coming up next week, we've got Rob Savoy talking about Ganache, which is the open source Flash replacement or Flash emulator. John L. Bacon will be back with us for that show. So he's been sorely missed for, not sorely missed, but he's been missed for the last couple of weeks.
Well, the truth is we haven't missed him at all. But okay, go ahead.
Okay, can we talk smack about him since you guys talk smack about me?
We didn't miss him one bit. Sorely missed. Yeah, whatever. Okay. No.
Well, it's the being able to do an authentic British accent, and neither of us can do that as well as he can. So we've got, speaking of British accent, we've got Danny O'Brien and Jim Killock who are on the following week. They're basically the open rights group, which is, from what I understand, the equivalent to EFF for Europe, although there's also an EFF Europe, so I don't know what the difference is. But we also have a bunch of people the following week talking about BioPearl. I thought it would originally be Marc Pelletier and Edward Seufert, but Edward was just the guy that suggested we have the show. So I'm still looking for the actual couple of guests for that show. But Mark was certainly going to join us as being part of the co-hosts, actually, on that show. So it'll be a lot of fun. Also just added to the schedule, I believe, Wolfgang Meyer. He created the Exist database, which is an XML-based tree database. One of the hard things you deal with when you're dealing with XML is putting it into a standard relational database, and he's got an XML database that's really great for querying trees of information instead of rectangles of information. That's going to be really cool. Probably the most exciting guest that I've booked in the last couple of weeks is a name you're probably familiar with, Mr. Laporte.
Oh, I'm so excited. You got Britney Spears?
Okay, well, no. The next one. The next one down.
Who?
Comparing very closely to Britney Spears would be our old friend, Chris DeBona.
That was my very next guess, yes.
I could tell. Chris, I bumped into Chris 2 weeks ago at AstroCon, and one of the things that we chatted about briefly was the idea of having him come on this show once again to update us on where open source has gone over 3 years, at least as far as his perspective gives him the opportunity to see by being at Google and looking at talking to a lot of different open source projects. So I'm very happy to have him on. I believe that's also going to be our 100th show. The 100th Floss Weekly.
He should be on our 100th show. That's great.
Very nice for that. And, and then coming up slightly after that will be Matthew Gaetz talking about Stellarium, which is a planetarium program for a cross-platform. They're having a new release. We'll bring him on for that. On the short list, we've got some Uncle Bob Martin. We've got Monty Wydenius talking about MySQL and so on. But anyway, go to the list. You'll see it all there. Also, I am going to be at Ignite Portland coming up in a couple of weeks. I am rehearsing my talk over and over again. I'll be doing that live on Ustream. So watch my Twitter account, twitter.com/Merlin with a Y, M-E-R-L-Y-N, so you can see when I'm going to be live rehearsing my 5-minute talk for Ignite. So follow me on that. So there's the upcoming guests, and there's my Twitter handle.
Well, all in one sentence. I don't think you even took a breath. It's amazing.
No, it's practice. Lots of practice, yes.
Lots of singing like
Another
Kermit
great
the
show,
Frog.
Leo. Another
Thank
great.
You. Yeah, really, Puppet's fantastic. Bear in our chat room, our sysadmin said, basically Puppet's designed to replace me. Never, Bear. Never, because a puppet can never grow a beard.
Definitely true.
Yeah, no, but a Bear might want to use it. That's for sure. All right, Randall, hey, next week I look forward to the show then, and we will see you, everybody. If you want to watch us do it live, we do it live at 1:30 Pacific. That's 4:30 Eastern. Let's see. Because the change in summertime to wintertime is happening.
21:30 Zulu, not 20:30 Zulu.
Boy, you're good. Do you have a little Perl script that does that?
Oh, no, my brain. It's all in my brain.
21:30 UTC. We will see you at live.twit.tv or just subscribe to the show. It's on every podcatcher, including Mediafly, and soon you're going to be able to watch your Mediafly stuff on all the devices like the Roku and the iPhone and the Android and the Palm Pre and all of that. So if you haven't, keep an eye peeled for that Twit application or just download Mediafly right now. Actually, if you have a Palm Pre or a Google phone, I have a code for you.
A code?
Yes. You can.
Is it a Da Vinci code?
You can. It's a Da Vinci code. If you text the word TWIT, T-W-I-T, to 30364 on your Palm Pre or on your Android, on your Android platform, you will get sent a link to an OTA download of the TWIT application. You'd be the first in your block to have it.
Cool.
How do you like them apples?
Really?
Yeah.
If I had one of those, I'd really enjoy that. Yes.
Well, I'm actually looking. There's a lot of new Droid phones coming out soon, including two from Motorola that I'm very intrigued by.
I am enjoying the TWIT application on the iPhone, though.
Isn't that great?
The new update was really nice.
Houdini7, thank you, dude. He's done a nice job of that. Yeah, you can listen. It's the easiest way to listen to the show, and it works even on Edge. So if you have an iPhone, do a search for TWIT in the iPhone store, and you'll get the new TWIT application. We rebranded it from twit.am to just TWIT because it's got everything. You see, it's playing right now.
You can even accidentally push the button that calls you on your live Saturday show.
You can call 8888 Ask Leo. Yeah, there's a little warning that's about to call. It's got time zones. It's got your chat room. This is beautiful. He did such a nice job. Houdini7 even has the calendar, so you'll know what shows are coming up. And downloads for video. Wow. Boy, that's slick. All right, Randall, we'll see you next week. Say it again. All right, Randall, we'll see you next week on Floss Weekly.